And I said, that's fine with me. Tonight, we are going to take up a word that is used only one time in the New Testament. And I'm going to expect you to be able to define what that word means. Comprehended? Okay. We're going to be in the book of Galatians for a little bit anyhow. Galatians. Can anybody name a church that is in Galatia? It is not Health and Dry.
Several in Galatia.
I just went one. Well, how about Lystra, Derby, Iconium? Those names sound familiar? Those are cities where Paul and who was with him on the first trip?
Barnabas.
Where Paul and Barnabas traveled. And they converted people there. There were congregations established. And not only were they established, they were equipped. Because there were elders appointed in those churches when Paul and Barnabas came on the return. Now we're going to jump forward about 20 plus years. There's a problem. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Before we end our lesson, let's go to God in prayer. What's going on in Galatia? Something is wrong. It's hard to imagine, at least from my perspective, that within just a relatively short period of time, so much has gone wrong among those brethren, among those Christians. And they are Christians. They are not people who are sort of half-hearted in their devotion to the Lord. They evidently were bona fide, genuine converts to the gospel. And they had the best teacher that could be found, Paul himself. But in the intervening period, something has happened that Paul is going to have to try to correct. Do you find it unusual that churches have problems? You can indicate, you don't have to shout out loud. But is it unusual for churches to have problems? The answer is no. Why?
Because humans have problems and they're made up of humans.
That's right, because they're made up of people, just like you and me. It's very fortunate that people learn the secret of getting along with each other and learn how to get along with God. But sometimes there are things that get in the way. Sometimes it's ego, sometimes it's from outside. In this case, I think it's from outside. Can you tell me anything about the people who might compose at least these three churches in Galatia? Are they pagans? Are they Gentiles? Jews? What are they?
Judaizers.
Sir?
They were Jews who were teaching the Old Testament law.
Okay. Well, I have just a little bit different slant on that. I agree with the last part, but I believe these are basically Gentile people. Now, that's not to say there were no Jews among them. And we're going to see, at least I think, in some of the context, that it's fairly evident that the bulk of the people in those churches were converted from idolatry. They became Christians because someone like Paul confronted them with the answer to their problem. And their problem is, I'm lost and what can I do? So whenever Paul goes there, converts the people, he leaves them in good shape. And as far as I know, he does not write any letters to them except this one. And this one is a doozy. You know who that man is? Surely you know who that is. This is a picture that I took of it. Not really. This is Father Abraham. Now, you probably didn't know Abraham looked like that, but we're just going to say this is Abraham. And the reason that I have put Abraham's picture up here is because Paul mentioned this man at least 10 times in this letter. Now, there's a reason why he does that. And as we go through this, I think you'll understand why. Well, what is going on in Galatia? Well, here are some things that Paul says, and this is an amazing statement. Paul said, I'm amazed. Just imagine what all Paul has seen in his work as an apostle. It really would take something to amaze him, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you? I mean, we've seen lots of stuff in our life, but rarely do we say, wow, did you see that? Well, Paul says, I'm amazed. Any idea of what he's amazed about? Yeah. He says, I'm amazed that you have left the Lord so fast. Now, here is Galatia. Right here. And here are these cities, Lystra, Derbe, and Iconium. I suspect that these are the cities where Paul went. Now, it's really not absolutely necessary. It's not critical for our lesson tonight to know where these places are. But they're in the Bible, and we'll at least have an idea about at least what continent they're on, which is
Asia.
That's right. So, what's the deal? Why is Paul amazed? Here's what he says. That you are so quickly, what's the next word? You have deserted Christ. How is that possible in just a short period of time? I say short. From my perspective, 20 years is a short time. Now, maybe from yours it's not. But Paul hadn't been gone from there much over that period of time. And something has happened in that length of time that has completely changed the complexion of these people. Let me rephrase that. That might be taken the wrong way. Has completely changed the demeanor of these people and their attachment to Christ. What's the deal? Well, here's the deal. Somebody or somebodies have come from outside, outside the Galatian church, and they're bringing some strange teaching with them. What is the teaching? The what?
You must be circumcised.
No kidding. Now, is circumcision a biblical subject?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a large part, maybe not so large, but there is a major percentage of people who become Christians that this would not apply to in the first century, at least from these teachers' perspective. Who might that be? Let me rephrase that. I'm looking for a gender.
Women.
Women, that's right, women. Isn't that kind of strange, you know, in order for a man to be a fully recognized citizen of Israel, he had to be circumcised. What did the women have to do? They just had to be born, I guess. But in this case, what these folks are saying is that a man must be circumcised if he's a Gentile in order to become a Christian. It's kind of interesting that the women are not even in this picture. That ought to be a clue, you know. Do women have to do anything differently from men to become Christians? No. In fact, in this very letter, Paul is going to say, there is no male and there is no female, no circumcised, uncircumcised, etc. So, why are these folks doing this? I mean, are these honorable people who honestly believe that the only way that a Gentile can become a Christian is to be circumcised? Why do they teach this?
That's what they've always believed.
Are their motives pretty good?
I think they were losing their influence.
Look at the bottom part of this statement. That they may boast in your flesh. What does that mean?
Lord on my side.
They can brag on, you see, I've made some converts over here. So it's not, I think, that they are so convinced that what must be done is that Gentiles must be circumcised to become Christians. But you know, just, we need the bragging rights here. And so they had evidently converted a number of these Galatian people to their way of viewing circumcision and the state of the Gentiles who want to become Christians. Now, here's the question. No, I'm sorry, that's a statement. Aren't you kind of amazed, along with Paul, that this could happen so quickly? I mean, this is an apostolic church. You understand what I mean by apostolic church? It was founded by an apostle, and he evidently spent some time with these people. He's very attached to them. And aren't you kind of amazed that these people just could, it looks like they've turned on a dime and said, Paul, you know, we like you, but we found somebody who we like better. Here's the question that introduces our subject tonight, and that is, how can Paul help these people? How is Paul going to be able to convince them that you're incorrect? Is that Paul's, is that his object? Does he really want to help these folks? Sure he does. I mean, why wouldn't he? Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I think this is the verse that I want. And, no. Let's see, where he well, that just went in one ear and ran out the other. The point I'm looking for is that he lists all of the things that he had suffered. He'd been in shipwreck, a night and a day, he's been on the deep. And all of these things are very important, but he said the greatest problem is that I bear the burden of all the churches. The welfare of the brethren was the greatest ball and chain that Paul dragged around with. Because he says, the idea is that who is going to fall away? And I'm not concerned about it. So Paul has a great regard for the welfare of brothers and sisters wherever they are. But it seems especially for those that he had labored with in the past. And so, I take it that Paul has an honorable and an honest desire to help. Now, let's just say, here's our problem. How do we help these people? Have any ideas?
To look back at their history, probably.
Sir?
You have to look back at their history, I believe.
Whose history?
Well, the Jewish history, I believe.
Okay, well, let's see. What Paul could do is say, do not become circumcised. Well, why? Because I said so. You ever deal with your children that way? I can remember my daddy saying, because I'm daddy. My father didn't use the word daddy. That was too colloquial for him. Because I am your father. You do it because I said so. And that is a good reason why we should obey our parents. But really, truly, that doesn't convince me that this is the right thing to do. It only tells me that I need to obey my dad because if I don't obey him, I know what's coming next. That doesn't convince me and motivate me to really desire to do what he wants me to do. Paul could have said, you do it because, after all, I am an apostle. And it's interesting that he takes great pains in this letter to prove his apostleship. What other letter does he labor so long in trying to prove he is a genuine bona fide apostle? None. But for some reason, Paul has to convince them, I am an apostle. I did not learn what I teach you from men. I didn't receive it from man. I didn't get it from the other apostles. I received it by revelation. So he is telling them, I could tell you what to do because I'm an apostle, but that really would not, in the long run, do much good. The elders could say, this is what you're going to do. And if you're going to fear in a reverential sort of way the shepherds of the flock, would you do what they say to do? Yes. But wouldn't it be better if they would explain, now this is why we want you to do this. And you can say, yeah, I see that. I understand that. And I'm behind you and I'm ready to do this. So Paul is challenged to find a way in which he can convince these people whom he loves to do what they ought to do and be convinced that they're doing it because it's the right thing to do. So here is his challenge. He says, I'm going to patiently teach you. That's the hardest thing to do, isn't it? What you really want to do with some people is kind of take them by the throat and throttle them real good and say, you listen to me. But Paul uses terminology which prevents that kind of thing. He calls them brethren 10 times in this letter. Now, I'm a counter. I count things like this. And I've counted some other stuff in here we're going to see. But it's really kind of important to recognize that when Paul addresses these people, he doesn't say, hey, you. He doesn't say, you rascals over there in Galatia. He calls them brethren. Are they really his brethren? But they're not on the same page doctrinally, are they? No. Now, there may come a time when if they can't get on the same page, something else must be done. But at this point in time, Paul says, listen, brothers, we need to talk about this. Secondly, in chapter 4 and verse 19, he calls them my little children. My little children. Is that a term of endearment or is it a put down?
Endearment.
It's endearment. In fact, you can see in the very next phrase, it's not just a matter of endearment, it is heartfelt. This is the only place in the New Testament where Paul describes himself as a mother. What does he say there? Last phrase in verse 19 of chapter 4. Then he says something about, he said, I am in labor, sort of, so to speak. I'm in labor until Christ is formed in you. Now, what does that tell you? Is Paul sort of one of these guys that says, listen, folks, don't you understand who I am? I'm the big cheese around here. Or does it tell them that I am in agony over your defection from the truth and I am in pain until Jesus Christ is formed in your conscience? Well, you can see that Paul is not going to lay the law down to them in the sense that he's going to read them the right act. He's going to try to convince them that you need to change your course. And so he says, let me draw you a picture. Now, the picture is found in chapter 4. And here's the picture. Got that? Abraham is mentioned, I think, 10 times in this little letter. Imagine that. How long has Abraham been dead? I mean, from Paul's perspective. 100 years? 500? 1,000? How about 2,000 years? So he's been dead almost 2 millennia. What's the deal with this guy? Why is he so important? Father Abraham. I mean, everybody who knows anything about the Old Testament recognizes he is patriarch numero uno. He's the first patriarch. He is the man who started it all. So Paul is going to use him as an example. Actually, he is going to use him allegorically. There's the word that I said you need to define. This is the only place in the New Testament this word is used. It's an adverb. He says, I'm using this allegorically. What is an allegory?
Figure of speech that uses a series of other figures involved.
Okay. In other words, it's kind of like a picture or a story, or it could be events, it could be people. And the people who are used for the purpose of illustrating something. So he said, we're going to take Father Abraham, and I'm going to talk about him allegorically. Now, where do you first read of Abraham in the Old Testament? I don't want just the book. I want the chapter. But I'll take the book first. Genesis. Chapter.
12.
Bzz. Wrong.
11.
11. That's correct. He is first introduced in chapter 11 because he is in the lineage of the man. These are the generations of whom? Terah. So, here's where the picture of Abraham comes in. And he's not really any outstanding individual at the very beginning. He's just one of the list of children that come from a family of Terah. But pretty soon, everybody's going to drop out in importance, and Abraham is going to assume almost a superstar status because God is going to appear to him and make a promise to him in chapter 12 that involves three things. Can anybody name the three things that the promise involves?
Great nation.
Great nation.
Land.
Okay. In your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Now, it's important to look at that term seed. Now, seed implies something. It implies something that Abram does not have. What?
Children.
Okay. How old is Abram when he gets this promise?
75.
So the years start ticking by. And they tick. And they tick. And finally, 14 years later, is it 14? Yeah. Abram is 89 years old. That's not correct. Let's see, if he's 89, he's 85. 87, you're right. We'll split the difference. 87. He doesn't make this decision for him. His wife, Sarah, makes the decision, and her decision is, listen, it's obvious we're not going to have any children, so here's my handmaiden. What is her handmaiden's name?
Hagar.
Now, it's kind of interesting that Hagar's name is going to be... Oh, but before we even get to Hagar, here is what Paul says. In the picture, how many sons did Abraham have?
Two.
Two sons. Now, actually, that is... historically, kind of an inaccurate statement, because Abram had a lot more sons than that after Sarah died. But for the purpose of the picture, this is exactly right. Now then, did each of these sons have the same mother?
No,
they did not. The first son, what's that guy's name?
Ishmael.
The first son had Hagar as a mother. Correct? Okay, let's see. Then 14 years later, that doesn't work out right, does it?
13.
See, I'm not very good at math. I'm good at 4 years. Abram is 99 years old. And God has been telling him all along, you're going to have a son, and the son is going to come from your loins. And finally, Sarah gets pregnant, and she has a son. It's kind of interesting, though. In this picture, Sarah's name is not mentioned in Galatians. Did you notice that? Kind of odd. Hagar's name is mentioned, but not Sarah's name. I don't think there's a reason for that. So here's the picture. Is it historically an accurate picture? Yeah, it is. One son by Hagar, one son by Sarah. Now,
The son that comes from Hagar is named Ishmael. The son that comes from Sarah is named Isaac. Okay, the second great patriarch. Now then, what do you think is the purpose for Paul's introducing this picture? I mean, what has that got to do with circumcision? Anything? Well, sort of.
Sets them apart.
Sir?
Sets them apart.
Yes, but
bind and free is...
That's part of it, yes, yes. But do you realize that Abraham is the first man that you read about in the Old Testament who's circumcised? Maybe that's just a happenstance. But he's going to prove something by using Abraham as a picture. Now, he says, listen, you have to make a decision about where you want to go. Because here are some things which are connected with the birth of Hagar's son, Ishmael. It is of the flesh, Hagar's the mother, and this correlates to Mount Sinai and Jerusalem. Now, what is the deal about Mount Sinai? What happened there? The law. What about Jerusalem that now is? I'm using now is as colloquial with Paul, contemporary with Paul.
Temple.
Okay, the temple. So what do you associate that with?
The Jewish.
Sir?
The Jews.
Okay, the Jews and the Old Testament, the Old Testament law. Now, and I meant to bring this up before, but I want you to look at verse 21, chapter 4, 421. And you notice something odd about this. I'll read it. Tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not listen to the law? Well, on the surface, that's a perfectly legitimate question. You want to be under the law? Okay, then obey the law. But did you notice that the example that he gives is not from the law of Moses? What's it from? The book of Genesis. Now, does that mean that Genesis is the equivalent of the law? No. But if you were to ask a Jew, what are the divisions of the Old Testament? They would say the law, the prophets, and the writings. The law covers the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So now Paul says, listen, if you want to be under the law, you need to listen to what the law says. And here's what it shows. Here is Hagar's son, Ishmael. Now, let's look at the son that Sarah has. And after all, this is the son of promise. Who promised him?
God.
God did. Was this an immaculate conception?
No.
Well, but he says this one is of the flesh. Well, what that means is this is little Sarah's deal. You take my handmaid. This young man, Ishmael, was not the son of promise. He was just simply the son of natural generation. Isaac, on the other hand, is another story. So, connected with Isaac, promise, free, our mother, and the son's name is Isaac. By the way, does anybody know what the name Isaac means? My grandfather's name is Isaac. That's not how I know what it means, though. It means laughter. You connect that to something. So, they have to decide, whose children do you want to be? Do you want to be Hagar's children, or do you want to be our free mother, the woman who gives freedom? Well, let's see. You got to make up your mind. Now, I may be tempted to oversimplify this, but what Paul is saying is, listen, I'm going to give it my best shot. What I've shown you is that if you want to be under the law, which circumcision is a part of the law, and so if you're going to be circumcised, you've got to listen to what the law says, but you need to recognize that this son that was born to Hagar is not the son of freedom. It is the son of slavery and bondage. And if you want to be in slavery and in bondage, then go right ahead and do what you need to do to be a part of the Mosaic covenant. On the other hand, if you really want to be free, then you make your decision about what you're going to do. here is the son, and here are the mother, and here are the children. That's clever, isn't it? And these are all slaves. Was there ever a point in their time when they were literally slaves? Yeah. They were slaves for hundreds of years in Egypt. So they ought to know something about slavery. Now, if you knew that you could choose to be either a slave or free, which would you choose? Freedom. I mean, anybody could make that decision. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to do that. So he said, what you have to do is you have to determine where you want to be. And this is your choice. You know where Paul wants them to be, don't you? You know he wants them to be not on, whoops, I'm sorry, where did I go?
Hit that center blank button. Hit it again.
This one? It's on the doodad. Maybe I turned it off. Hell. I see what I'm talking about. But just imagine up here on the screen, up on that side, this is the side where Sarah's son is. Sarah's son, Isaac. And Isaac is the son of promise. For how long had God been promising a son for Abraham before he ever got him? 25 years. A quarter of a century. That's a long time, isn't it? And I guess they got impatient. But the fact is, God does not operate on the same time frame that we do. 25 years, in some respects, sounds like a long time. And if I had been praying for 25 years, God, please give me a son. Please give me a son. Every night I pray, please give me a son. And when 25 years go by, do you think maybe in year 26, I wouldn't be quite as... I wouldn't be quite as quick to pray, give me a son, because it's obvious that God's not going to give me a son. We get so impatient, but in the big picture, God said, that son is coming, just be patient.
Was there any indication that Abraham disbelieved that, or just Sarah? I mean, she...
No, he did not. He did not falter in unbelief.
She convinced him to...
Well, yes.
I don't remember him having those doubts. He's helped me help too much.
Well, that may be so, but I'm sort of at a loss to explain. Why in the world did he agree with Sarah? Why did he agree to do that? Now, what he agreed to do is not an unusual thing, culturally speaking. That was not something that was brand new. It was done often. So why did he do it?
I say it's the will of God. It has to be in the way it worked out.
Well, I mean, there's no question that God's will can take all of these little anomalies in life and work them out to where they come out exactly where he wants them to be. But I'm sort of at a loss to explain why Abram acceded to his wife's desire. But he did. And whether I understand it or not, that's just a part of the story. Now, there's something interesting that's going to happen after Isaac is born and these two boys are brothers. Real brothers? Same father, different mothers. So, do they kind of wrap their arms around each other and say, brother, I love you? What happens? Who is the bully? Ishmael's the bully. And what finally happens is that they get in a scuffle, evidently, and it's obvious and it's seen. And what eventually happens?
Abraham sent Hagar and his son away.
Why?
Because of the problems.
Yes, but whose idea was it? Well, yes, but it was Sarah's idea. Send them away. He will not be an heir. But it's interesting that in verse number 30 it says, but the, what does the scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be an heir with the son of the free woman. That's what the scripture says, but that is not a quotation. That is an almost quotation. But she is the one who came up with this plan. And Abram was saddened by it, or Abraham, and he sent Ishmael away from Isaac. But the point that Paul is making is, listen, where does the trouble that Christians face come from in Paul's day? From the Jews. Every place he went on that first journey in Asia, who were the antagonists in the matter? The Jews were. And that's the point that he's making. He said, so listen, when you survey all of this, when you look at the picture and you see what Isaac has done and where Isaac is the son of promise. If you want to cast your lot with Isaac, then you'll truly be free. Am I home? No, I'm not. You'll truly be free. But if not, what do you think what is the answer to the if not? Think about what Paul says, what the scripture said. Cast out the bondwoman and her son. When Jesus gives certain parables, like the parable of the great banquet, and there was a man there who did not have on the proper attire. Do you recall what Jesus said about that man?
Cast him into outer darkness.
Cast him into outer darkness. Isn't that interesting? Now, this statement is not made just for shock value. This statement is made to emphasize the truly serious nature of the decision that these Gentile Christians are going to have to make. You're going to have to decide to cast your lot with either Ishmael and Hagar or with Sarah and Isaac. Because if you make the wrong choice, just look at the historical record, that's where you're going to be. Now, this is not the only information that Paul gives to these people about what choice they should make. But I think this is really an illustration of Paul's, I hate to use the word fatherly advice, because that might tend to cloud the issue a little bit. But the fact is, it tells us that Paul is not willing to just cast these people out. He said, Let me help you to change your mind. And I'm going to give you information that anybody can see and anybody can listen to and obey. Make the right choice. Did they? I wish I knew. Because there is no follow-up letter. This letter is the only one that Paul wrote to them. I hope they made the right choice. Now, is there any lesson in there for today? Well, sure. One lesson ought to be that when somebody makes the wrong choice, you don't jump on them with both feet to start with. What you need to do is to patiently teach them, encourage them to make the right choice. And that applies not just for individuals, that applies to preachers, that applies to elders, that applies to anybody who wants to make an impact on another person's life. Well, I take it that my time is up. Thank you. If you don't have the lesson on Jerusalem, a